sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Do you think you might have migraine? Talk to your healthcare professional about your symptoms, the number of days they impact your life, and which treatment options might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. The Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today. And by Neurelis, a leading neuroscience company focused on the development and commercialization of therapeutics for the treatment of epilepsy and other neurologic disorders. The company's unique drug portfolio strives to address unmet needs in patient care. Learn more at Neurelis.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, a neurologist who practices at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. This is What's Health Got to Do with It, which looks at where and how healthcare intersects with your life, helping you get the medical answers you want. Coming up, happy spring! And back by popular demand, our staff picks their favorite healthcare books for everyone's reading taste so far this year. But first, the weather outside is warming up, and what a perfect time to curl up with a good book outside at the beach or under a tree, especially with all that extra daylight. We found three more healthcare books for all your tastes, whether you want to learn about the aftermath of COVID, read a medical mystery fiction novel, or catch up with a fascinating memoir. Here at What's Health Got to Do with It, our team has you covered. First up, my personal pick of Lance Fogan's novel, Dings. I recently spoke to Dr. Fogan from his home in Los Angeles. Over my long medical career with a focus on epilepsy care, I've strived to advocate and share the stories that my patients present to me as I seek solutions for their condition and try to assure an excellent quality of life. My goal has always been to illuminate the plight and the unique journey that individuals with epilepsy and chronic seizures must traverse as they manage their lives with this extra burden. As much as I can lecture about all of this, many people often can't empathize unless they walk in the shoes of the person and their family, something that is impossible to do sometimes. Our next guest found a better way. He wrote a fiction novel on the topic and let those characters tell their story. The result is magic. In his book, Dings, now available on Kindle and in paperback, he tells the tale of a young boy with a mysterious medical condition and how his mother and his dad, who is stationed in Iraq, navigate this major change in their life. Lance Fogan is a neurologist and author, and he joins us from his home in Los Angeles. Dr. Fogan, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Joe.
Congratulations on a terrific book. I've read it. It is wonderful.
Thank you.
I wanted to just ask the simplest of questions. What led you to write this?
I was in a literature writing class for 20 years, every Saturday, privately in my teacher's home. And I was interested mostly in getting educated, reading Dostoevsky and Fitzgerald and Chekhov, the famous authors, which I'd never really read before. And after about 8 or 9 years, with some of the people in the class writing their own works, my mentor said, Lance, why don't you write something? So it was back in 2009, when in the Los Angeles Times, there was an article by David and his wife Susan Axelrod, Obama's primary advisor.
Sure.
And they wrote about the devastating epilepsy in their adult daughter since childhood. And I thought, I could write about that, epilepsy. And the title, Dings, I came right to me at that point as my, and I thought I would make a young child have unrecognized complex partial seizures, non-convulsive type, where they people just blank out, because my oldest grandson at that time was 8 years old, and I was pretty much into his life and what he does at school, et cetera, et cetera. And I just thought of the title. He does not have epilepsy, but I just thought of that title. And that's what an 8-year-old might call an unrecognized strange thing that happens to them, which would be these non-convulsive blank-out seizures. And an 8-year-old might call it dings.
I love it. I like the way you kind of thought it through. I'm curious, are these characters real people, or did you base them on patients, or who did you base them on?
I based it on my clinical experience, but the novel primarily is a woman's story because it's told by the mother as she deals with the stress of the school telling her they're going to fail her bright third grader, move him back to second grade, he's just not keeping up. And because the dad was in 2007 Iraq on his second tour, which he volunteered for, the mother was very bitter about this. And she had to deal with the school and the problems alone. So it's primarily a woman's story, and the underlying theme is what she's dealing with and how they come to realize that it's epilepsy. And the novel, yeah, besides being a soft cover and a Kindle ebook, it's also an audio book, too. And so some people have told me they enjoy it in the car.
I love it. You know, the way you framed how you mentioned it's a woman's story, your character, the central character, could have easily had any number of medical conditions. Why choose seizures and or epilepsy?
Well, as a neurologist, we're all very familiar with, and much of our practice deals with people with epilepsy. And the story that inspired me to start writing something was the Axelrods, Obama's
sure.
advisor, and how significant their life is affected by their adult daughter who has uncontrollable seizures. So I just took it from that idea. And because I was so familiar, like all neurologists are, with epilepsy, and it's a fascinating story, and that 1% of the population. I talked to a lot of people lately about various business things and bankers, et cetera. And then I tell them, I always ask, do you know anybody with epilepsy? To drum up a little business for my book, but also to educate. And more times than not, they'll say, well, yes, I do, and my wife has it, or some relative has epilepsy. But they really don't know. They're shocked when I tell them, you know, when you go to a big venue, some sports event or some meeting, and you look around, there are a few hundred people or 1,000 people, you can bet that there are quite a few people in there with epilepsy. But half of them are well-controlled if they're on the right drug at the right amount, and that's trial and error. So that's half of them. So there could be a lot of people with epilepsy that you wouldn't recognize because they seem to have no problems. But then the other half of those that are uncontrolled. Then I ask people, one out of 100, and I caution them also about, tell your relative or your friend not to take a bath or a shower unless the door is open in someone's home, because right now I know of 17 people drown in the bathroom, including 5 who in the shower who fell face down and blocked the drain. And Mark Twain's adult daughter, Jean, at 1911, drowned in the bathtub. She had epilepsy.
Is that right?
But then I tell them, do you know of Chief Justice Roberts? And a lot of people never heard of him, but but many did. Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Well, he has epilepsy, and people are shocked, and they're all turned on by what I've told them. They said, "Gee, I learned a lot about what we're talking." And one out of every 100 people throughout the world has epilepsy.
That's fascinating. And you're right, it's a super common condition. I'm wondering what aspect of the medical journey for both the patient and in this case, the family, the mother, the dad who was in Iraq in your story, what were you trying to illuminate for the readers?
Well, that once the diagnosis is made, that people can still live a normal life if their seizures are not that bad and not uncontrollable. Most people will have some control, and then like half of the people will be fully controlled. And I wanted people to know that this is how a family deals with a medical problem like epilepsy, or there could be many others, and especially the non-convulsive type. So often it takes so long to be recognized and to be diagnosed. A pathologist friend of mine, when I was telling him about my story, he said, you know, that sounds like my nephew. Nobody knew what was wrong with him for about half a year. And then a friend of mine who's a school teacher of fifth graders, she said, you know, before I read your book, I didn't really know what was going on, but I had my fifth graders lined up, and they're marching along, and this one girl would suddenly stop and just stare straight ahead, and the kids behind her would bang into her. I said, what did you do? Well, I put her in the back of the line. But after reading your book, now I realize that it probably was epilepsy. So I want my book to really educate, too, and that's such a common condition.
I'm wondering if you could take a moment and read us a very brief passage from the book, something that resonated with you.
Okay. To me, I constructed how the diagnosis was made, and it happens in all neurologists' office, and only neurologists would ask this question of people who are found down. Nobody saw what happened. Was it a heart attack? Did somebody faint? But we should ask to rule out possible epilepsy. And my book, I said, "You're doing fine, Connor," the neurologist says to the young boy. This is very good, very helpful, as the boy is telling his experiences. But nobody knows he hallucinates these smells. And if I tell people, you know, it's very common that people who have the complex partial seizures, most coming from the temporal lobe, that there can be an aura, a warning of a smell. And if you Google the olfactory hallucination that with this kind of seizure, burning rubber is common. So the doctor says, now, do you ever imagine that you smell something that's not really there, that nobody else can smell? He's asking this 8-year-old, do you ever get a taste that just came into your mouth without eating anything? And Connor gave a tiny nod. Is it a smell or a taste, Connor? I think I smell something, but I don't know what it is. Well, is it that, like something bad, Connor? Like burning rubber? Something like that? Yeah. Connor's face brightened. He nodded vigorously. That's it. That's what it is. It smells like the things Daddy burns in his construction yard. Animated now, he scrunched up his nose, and his body rocked back and forth as he nodded. It's gross. The mother says, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I looked at Sam, my husband. What was Connor talking about? Why had he hidden this? So he, as an 8-year-old, inarticulate, immature, he never really complained to anybody about these things happening. And the parents were just shocked that the little boy had been living with this for a year or more, every few weeks, and never complained. And the mother then wondered, is this the reason why he's failing in school? Because the teachers never really noticed these little blankouts, but he's not keeping up. So they're at least reassured they have a reason why he's not doing well in school. But now they have to deal with a lifelong problem. And I remember when I was younger, older books, they show pictures of people in insane asylums, put there because of epilepsy, and they'd have these rashes on their face from the bromides people used in those days. So the mother immediately thinks of that when the doctor finally makes the diagnosis of epilepsy due to more than one spell. And the mother then asks the doctor, "Doctor, I don't have a normal baby anymore. Will he ever be able to go to college, drive a car, get married, have a career?" So the doctor has to convince her there's life, successful life with epilepsy, and brings up all the people, celebrities and scholars and doctors and Chief Justice Roberts that live with epilepsy.
I love it. What at least a hopeful tone. And I guess that's my question in our final moments. Without giving anything away, do you think the book is hopeful?
Well, it is, in that it shows that this is a family, and all families have problems, and all people deal with problems and have to overcome them. And this book shows how the mother and the father in their 30s, and this boy, 8-year-old, and his younger sister, 3, you know, they wonder, will the younger one develop epilepsy? Does it run in families? And all these questions come up. And this occurs in average families that then are facing a disease of some sort. So I think it's hopeful in that this is a common thing. People will recognize that what they're dealing with whatever their problem is, all of us deal with. So I think that's what my book is relaying.
I love it, and what a lovely message. Dr. Fogan, I want to thank you so much for sharing this book with us and for joining us on this program today to talk about
dance. Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about my book.
We've been talking to Dr. Lance Fogan. He is a neurologist and an author of the new book, Dings, found on Kindle, audiobook, and in paperback. Up next, our senior producer, Heather Schatz's pick, is Ryan Pryor's The Long Haul, about long COVID and its impact on the healthcare system. You're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin. If you're just joining us, we're talking about our favorite springtime health books of 2023. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at @JServin.
I selected Ryan Pryor's The Long Haul, which is all about long COVID and its impact on the healthcare system. My son has long COVID, so I tend to gravitate towards any literature I can find on the subject. There's not a lot of it out there yet, as we are learning about the disease and its impact in real time, so I was happy to see this come across my desk. Dr. Servin recently spoke to the author. Take a listen.
To the world's public health authorities, COVID-19 would either be a deadly disease for some, or it would be a simple respiratory illness that cleared up in a few days to weeks for most. But then tens of millions around the world got sick and stayed sick. With scientists and doctors caught off guard, these patients often found solace only in themselves, organizing support groups across continents while ill in bed. An innovative band of patients researched the disease themselves, flipping the script and illustrating, perhaps, a new paradigm for research. It was in these unprecedented times that the CDC and the World Health Organization came to them. COVID long haulers found their new illness wasn't so new. It resembled a number of post-viral syndromes, hard to treat, and neglected by science for decades. According to the CDC, new data from the Household Pulse Survey shows that more than 40% of adults in the United States reported having COVID-19 in the past, and nearly 1 in 5 of those, or 19%, are currently still having symptoms of long COVID. Our next guest has an amazing new book that helps tell their story, and if this condition gets solved, it could solve countless other ailments that are just like it. Ryan Pryor is a journalist who covered the COVID-19 pandemic as a features writer for CNN. His new book is entitled The Long Haul, Solving the Puzzle of the Pandemic's Long Haulers and How They're Changing Healthcare Forever. He joins us now from Atlanta. Ryan, welcome to our program.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here. So what led you to cover this part of the pandemic? I understand that you had your own personal health that kind of influenced this.
Yeah, part of the story of this book really starts in 2006 when I came down with a post-infectious or post-viral illness myself. And we didn't know it at the time. And I was a high school student, and it was difficult to diagnose, difficult to treat. We went to parents and I went to 16 different doctors and ultimately got this diagnosis of chronic fatigue syndrome, which is a something of a wastebasket diagnosis from the point of view of many medical practitioners. And the thing about myalgic encephalomyelitis or chronic fatigue syndrome is that it usually starts by a following a virus, so a lot of my life and career frequently was writing stories about this type of complex chronic disease as a either from a political perspective or from a scientific perspective, and I later did a documentary film about ME/CFS. All of that led into in 2020 when the pandemic started. All of us in the ME/CFS community or the post-viral community or the chronic illness community clearly understood that if a severe virus was going to sweep the globe and potentially infect just about everybody, a large number of people were going to never recover from that. And all of us had our own experiences with long-term disabilities having not recovered from our own viral infections. So I was very alarmed and made a real point in the first few months of the pandemic to cover people who had gotten COVID. And it was very obvious to me that a lot of people, 1, 2, 3 months into the early part of the pandemic, we were going to find the types of patients who weren't getting better. And so I continued just following the thread from there. And that's how the book project developed.
Thank goodness for that and to all the folks who read it, because I know that they're going to find it helpful. Can you tell us what, in your reporting, have people or scientists or experts, how they define long COVID? I mean, what is it exactly? And what symptoms are people reporting?
Yeah, so the broadest definition of long COVID could also be from the CDC or the World Health Organization. They talk about this as like a post-COVID conditions, and that could mean a whole lot of different things. And that's a very wide definition, which means like one or more new symptoms or one or more new diagnoses following in the wake of a SARS-CoV-2 infection that lasts for, different definitions will call for, more than 1 month or more than 3 months. So relatively long-term symptoms after an infection. That can span a large number of things. I mean, it could be organ damage. It could be long-term effects of just having been in an ICU or on a ventilator. So some of it's easily documented by the medical profession that is objective evidence. That would be obvious from if you had a severe infection. But what I'm talking about long COVID and what most long haulers are experiencing is that they have a long-term disabling illness, usually from a mild infection. So it was not severe enough to go to a hospital. And that is usually dysautonomic in character. It's a disruption of the autonomic nervous system. So the part of our bodies that regulates functions that we don't normally control with our mind. So and that can be at the immune system level, and the fatigue and brain fog and most importantly, post-exertional malaise or a failure to recover from exercise, or a failure to recover from even minor physical, emotional, or mental exertions. That's the characteristic trademark of ME/CFS. It's also a characteristic trademark of the long COVID condition. And then the other major symptom that most people, or other major condition that most people within the umbrella of long COVID has, postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, and their heart rate goes up more than 30 beats per minute upon standing, or upon just sitting up. And people are dizzy, and they are in danger of fainting. And so POTS and ME/CFS are the most common things within long COVID, as I present it in the book.
I'm curious with regards to so many people that are suffering from this condition in a very complicated, fragmented healthcare system. What do you think is going to be the biggest impact of having all those people having all of this at the same time with regards to just the system and perhaps even disability?
Yeah, so the we understand acute COVID to be, you know, a mass casualty event. There's a huge death toll, and that everyone knows that. That's been widely covered. The long COVID is probably a mass disabling event, which logically follows that for a lot of people who don't die, but who experience a severe virus, you know, something short of death is what we're left with, and that's this largest number of newly disabled people in a generation. Previous mass disabling events would include, you know, polio for my grandparents' generation, or HIV/AIDS for my parents' generation. So with each new global pandemic that unfortunately arises, you understand that there's a large number of death, but there's also a large number of disability. And so when people have fatigue and brain fog and PEM and POTS, it can make sitting up at a desk and doing a basic job becomes impossible. People can't read or can't make decisions, or they can't process information, and they can't, they can't even sit up straight. And so let alone, trying to commute to a job that's just for office workers. So if you were to extend it out to physical jobs like being a police officer or a firefighter, et cetera, it becomes clear that a lot of that is difficult, if not impossible. So that's where disability services and disability accommodations are going to be the most important thing for most people who experience long COVID. And if they cannot kick the illness, which there are no officially FDA approved drugs for this condition, we have to manage it through thinking more strategically and intelligently about disability, and making sure that the information is disseminated so that people can be taken care of, or at least find new ways to manage the disease. Because some people may be able to keep their job if they have, let's say, a different work shift, if they have a remote work arrangement, and maybe a slight change to their job descriptions. A lot of people would still be able to support themselves or to support their families. And so when people are forced to keep working and keep producing and keep earning, even though it goes against what their body is telling them it needs, people risk making their condition quite a bit worse.
What do we know about long COVID in kids? Is this common? Does this impact kids differently, or is this just one of those questions we're all going to figure out together?
Yeah, as with our knowledge of post-viral conditions, well before the pandemic, the there's no real age limit. And I tell people this is, from age 7 to 70. I mean, it could be, people as young as kindergarten and certainly people up into their 80s or older can experience long COVID or can experience ME/CFS. And it may get labeled differently. And for the older population, it may get, oh, this is just the person aging. And then for younger, for kids, especially when they're really, really young, it's just hard to even articulate a basic understanding of the world. And so those kids risk getting swept up into, a different set of diagnoses, and sometimes get accused. There can be accusations of the, Munchausen's, where like a parent might be making up a child's illness. There's different different sides of it. But I think the most important thing to note here is that age is not necessarily a discriminating factor for whether or not someone's going to get long COVID.
Got it.
It's certainly very common in kids.
One of the things that you write about in this book is the fact that this condition has flipped the script on traditional research. So how will long COVID impact future clinical research? How has it influenced this?
Yeah, when the medical establishment hasn't thoroughly documented it or thoroughly educated people, or just developed the evidence base around a condition, it automatically begs the question of, okay, where, how do we acquire the new knowledge? Where does it come from? Who has the knowledge? What's the best source? And in this case, this is really one of the largest ever natural experiments ever conducted in humankind, for better or for worse. And in this case, for potentially for better, is that you've got tens of millions of patients all experiencing the same thing at the same time. And qualitatively, it's easy to speak to them, and they can articulate and explain their illness dramatically better than anybody else. And this really comes back to a core tenet of that of medical education. So Sir William Osler, who's largely credited as kind of establishing the modern thought process around how we educate doctors, he talks about listen to the patient and he will tell you what the disease is. And that's a 19th century idea that can very easily be mapped onto a 21st century framework that listen to COVID long haulers and they will tell you what the disease is. And they've been telling us what the disease is. And a group like the Patient-Led Research Collaborative for COVID-19 has done some of the most impressive work and conducted a patient survey very early on in the pandemic and found 200 different unique symptoms across 10 different organ systems, and they've testified in front of Congress multiple times, and they've helped influence policy at the CDC and the WHO and a number of national governments, and many of them have backgrounds in science, but they more importantly have the lived experience of having the disease. So when you confuse human experience with scientific expertise, you get something magical. And when policymakers can listen to this, it really does give a prime example of how the medical establishment can evolve and take in new perspectives and new thoughts and new ideas and be more resilient in the face of this current pandemic. And I think that's super important for all other diseases and all other future pandemics, is that including the patient voice and then creating a more patient-centered healthcare system or a more human-centered healthcare system helps unsilo this very specialized, very bureaucratic system that we currently have. We're very good at treating certain very specific diseases, but when you got a multi-system sort of dysautonomic disease like long COVID, our system of separating everything into cardiology or rheumatology or infectious disease fails to see the whole picture, the whole human picture, And that's where I think this patient-led research and this human-centered design offers a lot for our healthcare system, not just for long COVID, but for a broad swath of other diseases as well.
Ryan, I'm going to let that be our last word. And I like that message of hope that in general, this may lead the way for perhaps many other conditions. Ryan, I want to thank you so much for joining us and also for a terrific and important book. We really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking to Ryan Pryor. He is a journalist and a features writer for CNN. And his new book is entitled The Long Haul, Solving the Puzzle of the Pandemic's Long Haulers and How They're Changing Healthcare Forever. Next up, our producer Brendan Rivers' pick, Code Gray, Death, Life, and Uncertainty in the ER. You're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and if you're just joining us, it's our favorite springtime health books of 2023. And we want to hear from you. If you have an idea for future shows, tweet me at jservin.
If a thought-provoking memoir from a frontline ER doctor is more your speed, you'll definitely enjoy Dr. Farzan Navi's book, Code Gray, Death, Life, and Uncertainty in the ER. Dr. Servin recently interviewed Dr. Navi from his home in New Hampshire.
Hi, I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and this is What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9. Of all the specialties in medicine, there's no other than emergency medicine that reveals the vital signs of what is ongoing in healthcare. Whether it's a pandemic, end of life, drug crises, the ER will be impacted first and often the hardest. As a doctor myself, I am so impressed with emergency medicine specialists, ER doctors, because they have to know the most extreme aspects of literally every specialty that exists and fill in the blanks with their experience and knowledge. This is the reason why stories told by ER doctors always catch my attention. Our next guest is Dr. Farzan Navi. He's an emergency medicine specialist in New Hampshire, and he has a compelling new memoir that tells the story of what practicing in the emergency room is like. His book is entitled Code Gray, Death, Life, and Uncertainty in the ER, and he joins us from his home in New Hampshire. Dr. Navi, welcome to our program.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's great. Okay, so let's start with a simple one that I got from a friend when they saw a copy of the book on my desk. They go, I know code blue, I know code black, I know code red, but I don't think I know what code gray is. What is code gray? And how did that become the title of the book?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, code gray is it's an allusion to really the reality of medicine as I perceive it, which is all the decisions we make, all the things that we face are really just different shades of gray. We like to think that things are black and white, that patients come in with a problem and then doctors provide the answer. But the reality is everything we do is just kind of on a spectrum, and we're trying to choose between risks and benefits and the right thing to do among a wide range of options. And the code gray is an allusion to all of that, whether it's something medical, philosophical, ethical, or whatever it is. The reality of my work and all of our work, really, is just trying to choose between many, many different options, all of which comes with the pros, all of which comes with their cons, and trying to figure out the best path forward, despite knowing that there's no true right path forward.
You know, I listened and read your book, but one of the passages that really struck me, particularly when I listened to the audio version of the book, was the part where you have a group of friends on text. And it almost, as I was listening to it, I felt almost triggered because of the fact that I felt like there was a tsunami of COVID issues about to hit you as you had each of these texts being told day by day. Can you talk a little bit about that text group that really struck me?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think tsunami is the right word, because that's really what it felt like at that time. But the text message thread, it was a group of 15 of us who all went through residency together. So 15 ER doctors. I began residency 10 years ago, so we've been in touch for about 10 years. So it was just really this core, trusted group of people who we used to share our own experiences, because at the end of the day, that's really what guided us during that time. The reality of COVID in the spring of 2020 was that things were moving really fast and they were really dramatic. And often the guidance we were getting from the hospitals or from the CDC was, you know, 1 or 2 weeks behind the reality that we were facing. So we really used this as a lifeline to help each other know what to do in that incredible circumstance. And originally, the reason I included it was, I'm very critical sometimes of our healthcare system, and I include a lot of that in the book in one way or another. And I didn't want anyone to read what I wrote and think, oh, Dr. Navi's so smart and he knew this thing that the CDC didn't know or anything like that. I really wanted to include all that to demonstrate that it wasn't me that knew anything, and this wasn't a doctor, a savior story. It was just that all of us who were on the ground in real time, I'm sure you as a physician who are working had similar experiences, but we all just kind of saw things before our institutions had the chance to catch up, and it was really obvious to all of us. So that's the genesis of that text message thread, but I think it was really useful to show people what it really was like on the ground during that tremendous time.
Mission accomplished. You know, I am curious about, now that you look at this from the rearview mirror, if you will, what's the biggest lesson that you learned from getting through the pandemic as a frontline ER doctor?
Well, there's a whole sorts of lessons. There's medical, ethical, philosophical lessons. Personally, my personal lesson is just that I've been humbled. There's just so much that we don't know and so much that we have so little power over. And it's really humbled me in terms of how I approach medicine, how I approach my patients, how I approach everything. And then there's the system component where, of course, there's a little bit of frustration where you think the system kind of failed us at that time. There were some good things we did, some things we didn't do well. And even the good things we did, it's interesting because we did step up in a lot of ways, and we provided free access to a lot of components of healthcare because of COVID, because we recognized that taking care of one of us is taking care of all of us in the face of a communicable disease. And then I realized that particular lesson, we didn't really learn that because we're now undoing all of those things, and the free testing and the free medication and all those things that existed and the vaccines, those are going away soon. So in that sense, it's a little disheartening to realize that some of the lessons that we did learn, even those were going back to the same system that we were in before we knew those lessons.
Yeah, that's such a true point. You know, there's also a lot of discussion about burnout in medicine. And forgive me if this seems personal, but did you ever feel like you got to burnout status?
Oh, I think it would be unreasonable if I said I didn't. I absolutely did. I think the latest survey that I saw this past year was that 65% of emergency medicine physicians report being burnt out. So it's just more likely to ask any ER doctor up the street if they're burnt out. The chances are they'll say yes by the statistics alone. But I do think that statistic says a lot. Not just that so many ER doctors are burnt out, but the number includes the genesis of why people are burnt out. Because if you think about it, I had this professor when I was in college, and I took a lot of human evolution and human behavior classes. And what he told me was that if you look at a variety of cultures across the world, and one or two cultures do things one way, and another culture does things another way, and another culture does things a third way, then you can say that's a cultural issue, whether it's food or music or dance or whatever.
Right.
But if you look all around the world and the overwhelming majority of cultures do things similarly, well, that's no longer a cultural thing. That's a human thing. And I apply that to burnout because if so many doctors are burnt out, that's no longer a doctor thing. That's now a systems thing. There's nothing wrong with these doctors who are burnt out. There's something wrong with our system that's causing it to be that so many ER physicians are burnt out. And I think that's really important because I do often hear a lot of people trying to address burnout and they talk about individual things we could do, whether it's therapy or meditation or whatever it is. And I think it's important to talk about burnout th- through the lens of our system and not talk about it as an individual problem just because the numbers are so overwhelming.
To that end, with regards to the system, one of your stories that really struck and I'd say even resonated with me is that you talk about a game that you play, which is called Puppy Dog versus Medical Degree. And to me, it seemed to summarize the problem with the system. Can you explain to our listeners, what is this game, the Puppy Dog versus Medical Degree?
Yeah, it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but it's a real game that I played. So in one of the hospitals that I used to work at, we had medical scribes. And for people that don't know, a scribe effectively follows you around the ER as you go see patients. And they write down what you say, your conversations, what you note out loud when you're performing an exam, and they create that into the medical note that goes into the patient's chart. But effectively what this does is that you have someone that you walk around with all day long that you become close with because you're spending a lot of time together one-on-one. So me and a scribe that I was working with, we created this game. It was called Medical Degree versus Puppy Dog. And the genesis of it, the point of it is that there's so many patients that come to the ER, and no matter what you do, they're dissatisfied. When you walk away and they walk away, they leave dissatisfied. And then you think about it and you realize they're not wrong to feel this way because our system fails them. Our system is so overburdened and so understaffed. Patients wait hours to be seen. And as a doctor, on my perspective, there's so many patients that are waiting to be seen who themselves are at risk of injury or death if I wait too long. So we're rushing and we don't provide patients what they really need, which is someone to sit down and listen to them and help them out through their process rather than just strictly keeping them alive, which sometimes is what we have to do because of the nature of how overburdened we are. So the game we played was if patients had either a minor problem or a more chronic problem, for example, where we did a bunch of work, but then they kind of ended up in the same position that they started in.
Right.
Cognitively, I might understand that I did a lot of things for them where I might have made sure nothing else was going on. I ruled out other causes. I provided the diagnosis. But at the end of the day, say you came in with some knee pain and I made sure you didn't have a knee fracture and I diagnosed you with a knee sprain. At the end of the day, it feels like we didn't do too much for you and you're unsatisfied. So we would maybe score a point for puppy dog in that scenario where we might think that, hey, maybe a puppy would have made you a little bit happier at the end of the day during the course of that visit than I, as a doctor with a medical degree, did. So we kept the tally and we would walk out of the room and I would say to the scribe I was working with, her name was Barbara, I'd say, hey, you know, do you think this one was medical degree or puppy dog? And, you know, oftentimes she would say, no offense, but I think puppy dog would have beat you on that one.
I love it. And it, like I said, it truly tells the story. In our final moments, Dr. Navi, are you hopeful for medicine changing? Is that a message that you hope to kind of deliver through telling your story?
It's tough. I go back and forth. I oscillate quite a bit. But to be honest, in this moment, I am quite a bit hopeful. And the reason for that, I think things seem like they aren't changing all the time and they seem like they'll never change. But my experience is that things seem like they will never change until all of a sudden they do. And I'm a little bit heartened recently because I think the coverage and the discussion around our healthcare system has shifted somewhat. And I think people are beginning to understand, whether it's through COVID or the after effects, that our system's really devastated and broken and we need to make some change if we're gonna do any better. I don't know if you remember, about 2 months ago now, there were some nursing strikes.
Yes.
In New York at Montefiore and Mount Sinai. And I think what was really compelling about them was not just that the nurses asked for things, but they won everything that they asked for. They got their raises, they got more staffing ratios for their patients, which they fought hard for, but also that the coverage around it, all the news reports and media that I read and heard about those were largely supportive of the nurses. And I think what that tells me is that people really are starting to get it. So I think that there's action starting to happen and there's support there as well. So I am optimistic from those fronts.
And I'll leave it on that message of hope for our listeners. Dr. Navi, I just want to thank you so much for spending some time with us and congratulations both for your new book and for a new member of the family as well.
Yes. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's wonderful to be here and chat.
Wonderful. We've been talking to Dr. Farzan Navi. He's an emergency medicine specialist in New Hampshire and the author of a compelling new memoir entitled Code Gray, Death, Life, and Uncertainty in the Emergency Room. Well, that's our program for today. We hope you've enjoyed our show. If you missed anything, you can listen to the full episode at WJCT.org and on your favorite podcast app. Thanks to all of our guests. Our executive producer is David Luckin. Heather Schatz is our senior producer. Brendan Rivers is our producer. Isabella Da Silva is our director. Next week's program is our March monthly medical roundtable show. If you have questions about this or any topic, let us know by calling us at 904-358-6362, email us at health@wjct.org, or tweet me at jservin. I'm Dr. Joe Servin, and you're listening to What's Health Got to Do with It on WJCT News 89.9 Jacksonville. Thank you for listening, and stay in touch.
Sponsored in part by Eli Lilly and Company. Is migraine impacting your life or daily activities 4 or more days per month? If so, ask your healthcare professional if you are a candidate for migraine prevention treatments and which ones might be best for you. Learn more at thinkmigraine.com. And the American Brain Foundation. For over 30 years, the foundation has worked with researchers to discover better treatment, prevention, and cures for brain diseases and disorders. Imagine life without brain disease. Learn more at AmericanBrainFoundation.org. And by the Epilepsy Foundation leads the fight to overcome the challenges of living with epilepsy and to accelerate therapies, stop seizures, find cures, and save lives. Visit epilepsy.com to find out how to get involved today.